Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. I thought it might be very appropriate, being that we have an election coming up. There's one that comes up every 2 years and one that comes up every 4 years. And the four-year one is very important this year to the elected president of the United States for all of the people, as opposed for a certain group of people. So it begs to me the thought of what other presidents that we've had that did something to help all of the people. And I go back as far as George Washington, the father of this country. And so my title today is, for what to show, let's look at the different presidents and certain dealings with slavery and what they did to help get rid of slavery. Of course, the first president of the Constitution of the United States was George Washington. Very wealthy farmer from Virginia. Came his father, he was born here, but his father came here and settled all of Virginia, which was at that particular time North Carolina, South Carolina, West Virginia, and Virginia. And since that particular time, it's been broken up. A surveyor, just like his father, and then later on, a surveyor and a father. Washington, the first president of the United States under the Constitution of the United States. He was not the first president of the United States. A lot of people get that sort of mixed up. The first president of the United States was John Hanson under the Articles of Confederation. That's when all of the states got together and fought for their independence. And, of course, George Washington couldn't have been there because he was traveling around the country as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. So under the Continental Congress, the first president of the United States was John Hanson, a very wealthy farmer from Maryland. All George Washington and John Hanson had something in common, though. They both owned slaves. And basically, George Washington did very little, if anything, as a person running this whole country, did anything to sort of bring people together of color as well as people who are white. He knew of black people and black persons. He actually knew of those that fought in the Continental War, in the Revolutionary War, as a commander-in-chief. He knew that there was a person named Liberty, because Liberty was one of the very first persons to receive a Medal of Honor and fought in the Revolutionary War, black person. He knew of a large number of free black people who actually fought. Crispus Attucks was the first person killed in the Revolutionary War on Bunker Hill. And so George Washington knew of and knew some of them personally. So he knew that they were giving their lives so that they can actually achieve freedom. But once the war was all over and the Constitution was drawn up, even though it talked about all men equal, he did absolutely nothing to free the slaves. They say actions speak louder than words. In his case, he had talked constantly about freeing slaves, but did nothing to do that, mainly because he owned them himself. In fact, he did nothing when he received his first slave. He could have freed him then, but, you know, when you're young like that, you're sort of forgiven for your mistakes. He received his first slave from his father. Actually, he when his father died in 1743, his father gave him 11 slaves. I don't know how he treated them at that particular time, but later on he treated them very badly. He did nothing for 8 years and served as president. And in that eight-year period of time, only talked about that. In fact, he owned over 100 slaves himself at that very moment when he became president of the United States. If they ran away, he would go after them, along with slave breakers, and beat them and whip them and circumnavigated any of the laws where a slave might be free if they went to a particular place and not be able to be brought back. He circumnavigated the laws completely, which allowed enslaved workers freedom if they did manage to escape to neighboring states. And when he died in 1799, get this, in his will, all of those that were domesticated were to be set free. However, only one of them immediately was freed. And he was an old man. I think he was in his late 60s. In that particular time, 60s is like today's 80s. Because those people were beaten, worn down. They were up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Worked. If you're out in the field, you worked until it was dark. And if you worked in your home, that there was domesticated ones where the ones that worked in the homes that cooked the food, they cooked breakfast, dinner, and supper. So, of course, if you're cooking supper for the slave masters, you don't get a chance to get free at an early time to go to bed or anything like that. And you have your own family to take care of. And in this case, it did not happen. And in the event, in 1759, he actually purchased 8 more slaves on top of the 11 that he had, making him one of the largest slave owners around that time, having 18 slaves. He took control of the slaves and, when his wife, Martha Washington, got married, she owned 80 slaves. Anything that was owned by a woman at the time, once she got married, it all became part of her husband. He was the one to control everything. So when you consider now, at that particular time, he had 11 and 8 is 19. He almost had 100 slaves when he got married when he was 28 years old. Eventually, he ended up having, when he first became president of the United States, he had 150 slaves dead. And when he left office, let's get this. When he left office, he had 317 slaves. Now, here's a man who's supposed to be the father of the country. You have to ask yourself, what country is he talking about being the father of? Who did nothing but talk about freeing slaves, but then owned, by the time he left office, 317 slaves. Talk is good. Talk is cheap. We also have a president of the United States today who has indicated he'd like to go back to the good old days. And I'm trying to figure out how far back he wants to go. Because if he goes back far enough, he'll be facing George Washington and 317 slaves. And that's very interesting. The next president of the United States that I've investigated and searched, there's so much more I could tell you about George Washington, but being that we have an allotment of time, it's going to be very difficult for me to spend just as much time on somebody I don't have that much respect for, even though he was president of the United States and he helped to do all the things that were positive. Let me add this one footnote. Do you know he was a Federalist? Do you know later on down the road, the Federalists became the Democrat-Republican Party, a combination of both, the Democrat and Republican, all were a part, came from the Federalist Party. Interesting. John Adams, who was the second president of the United States, was while George Washington was president, he was the vice president. And he became president, and he only served one term, unlike Washington, who served the complete 8 years. And by the way, George Washington was not elected. He was selected. Even though the Constitution of the United States, which had been drawn up, said that you had to be elected, George Washington was not elected. He was selected because of his views as a wealthy farmer who ran the farms, who cooked the meals, who made the clothes. All those were done by those particular people who were slaves. Let me go on to John Adams, and then we're going to go back and have you listen to some of the commentations or statements that are made about the whole litany of things related to slavery. I'm reading why I'm sort of lingering on that word slavery is because we might be facing a war of people of color if, in fact, this person who's now president of the United States stays in office because he wants to go back to the good old days, and that's segregation or slavery, one of the two, because cotton was king. And this country grew as fast as any country ever grew because of cotton. Well, let's stop it there, because I will continue. John Adams, the second president, became known as a passionate anti-slavery advocate in Congress. Of course, we know that as a vice president, he holds the deciding vote in Congress. In the House of Representatives. So he constantly referred to, as a matter of fact, the laws that were done in Massachusetts, where he was from, were changed dramatically when he became president of the United States. It became unlawful to buy a slave in Massachusetts. It became unlawful in New York. You could not buy a slave. You could import a slave, but you couldn't buy one in New York. You couldn't buy one in Massachusetts either. So he became known for his advocacy in trying to allow legislation to be discussed in Congress. It was a gag order that said that it was the rule that said that you could not even discuss slavery in Congress. So therefore, if you couldn't discuss it, how could you actually write up something to actually put forth information to Congress to vote on against that so that slavery could actually be a bygone product? Well, John Adams, to me, was the very first president to actually do something as to unite the country. By doing what he did, and later on became a lawyer to free some slaves, some Africans that got lost on a trip, and had a ship, came up and they were made to try to people tried to make them into slaves, but he defended them in court, even after he became was no longer president of the United States. Now you say, oh, how come he's no longer president of the United States? He only was president for one term. He served as a vice president for two terms, for 8 years. That was during the period of time when you didn't have to be a party or the next to become, for example, today our president selects who he wants as his running mate. Well, they didn't have that at that particular time. The one who got the most votes became president, or the one who got the most votes became vice president. And like I said before, George Washington wasn't elected. Wealthy farmers got together and asked him to be president. And in fact, he could have been King George, but he didn't want to do that. I guess he got real tired of actually doing what he did. Not being able to spend time at home and and build up his farm. In fact, I keep jumping back to George Washington like I want to talk about him some more, but I'm going to leave that alone. And let's go on and hear some other stuff of Africa to America. Let's listen to the slavery comments.
Hello, I'm Tim Lindsay, special guest moderator for Voice of America at Norfolk State University's Town Hall. Africa to America, the Odyssey of Slavery. Slavery is inseparable from America's story, but even after 400 years, it's still difficult for some to discuss. But we're going to do just that for the next hour, explain how this conversation is relevant, especially for today's youth. It all began in Angola.
Tropical Atlantic beaches dot its coastline. Angola looks so peaceful, but what happened here 400 years ago was not. From the shores of Angola to the shores of Virginia, Africans arrived against their will. First a few, then many human cargo traded to the early settlers. Their arrival marked a crucial turning point for an emerging colony helping transform vast wilderness into a new world. At what cost? What is the lasting impact? We will explore the legacy of slavery and steps forward in this town hall, Africa to America, the Odyssey of Slavery.
This August marks the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first Africans in colonial Virginia. Hello again. I'm Tennille Joseph, your special guest moderator and a history professor at the University of Texas. I want to acknowledge now some of our guests in the audience. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, and Ghanaian Ambassador Bakor Bewa. The start of slavery has shaped many things in American democracy. Joining me to discuss how is a distinguished group of panelists. Dr. Cassandra Luby Alexander is the Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norfolk State University and a history professor. Terry Brown is the superintendent of Fort Monroe, where the Africans arrived in colonial Virginia. Dr. Amy Glock is a professor of Africana Studies at the University of California, Northridge. Dr. Robert Vinson is a professor of history and Africana Studies at William & Mary College in Williamsburg, Virginia. And Dr. Gloria Brown Marshall taught Africana Studies at Vassar College and now teaches constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Well, I'm going to begin by asking you about 1619. This is the 400th anniversary of the arrival of Africans into what becomes the United States of America. I want to have a conversation about race, democracy, and citizenship. And what does it mean that the entire country really is focused on 1619? There's a New York Times project. And one thing to remember is that black folks a lot of times start things that then people catch up on. And way before the New York Times did the 1619 project, Hampton, Norfolk State, black folks in Virginia at the grassroots have been talking about democracy and slavery and freedom right here in Virginia. I want to start the conversation there, and we're going to start with you.
Okay. I'd first like to acknowledge two friends who really helped us start Project 1619 in Hampton, Virginia. Dr. Bill Wiggins, who is a retired professor of history from Hampton University, and Mr. Calvin Pearson, who has, you know, really carried the flag throughout the country. And it was in 2012 that we gathered groups of people, scholars, people who are community leaders together, to start having a conversation about 1619 and what that really means for American society. And so we asked the question, who are we? Who are really Americans? And that question is really at the foundation of 1619. because our national narrative erases people from that narrative. It erases people of color. Because even though Jamestown was founded, the Jamestown colony was founded in 1607, it really wasn't until 1619, with the formation of the first limited legislative body that set up the court system, that we knew that this colony would actually survive. And a month after that emergence of a legislative body kidnapped Africans from the central west African coast, were brought here, of course, against their will. They were twice kidnapped and brought here by two ships. The first one, the White Lion, arrived in late August of 1619, 3 or 4 days later, the Treasurer arrived with probably a total of about 32 people.
And I want to bring Lord Brown Marshall in here to talk about that.
Well, I want us to think about these issues, these concerns. These people kidnapped twice, stolen from their villages, brought them to the shores. They had to learn the language because Portuguese was the language that was spoken before, and we have a representative of Angola here, and I have traveled to Angola and understand that this relationship between the Angolans and the African Americans should be something strengthened. They had to learn the culture, the language, the economy, and they did this. So we have Marion Anthony Johnson. These people own land. They had servants of their own, these Africans, in the 1600s. We have Isabella and Antonio, and of course their son, William Tucker, becomes the first African child born here. We think of ourselves as these very sophisticated people, but we need to understand they had sophisticated ways of cultivating land. They had farming skills. They had ways to raise animals. But for our presence in that colony, it would have struggled and perhaps died off like Roanoke.
Superintendent, I want you to jump in here.
Well, it was an interesting conversation because it's one thing to teach African American history, it's another to work where the Africans actually landed. Mm-hmm. And it's very emotional because I drive through a bridge every day and I think about that all the time. My office is the former home of Robert E. Lee. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to let that sit for a second because when I travel into that fort, I often think, okay, the first Africans arrived here. It was a large stone fort, the largest in the United States. And that fort was built by Africans. So the same place where they were enslaved, they also gained their freedom through the contraband decision. And then you put the cherry on top and you say, okay, in 2011, President Obama would sign a document making it a national monument, at least a portion of the fort. Now, when you think about that 400-year arc, that's emotional. It's really emotional. And I'm so proud to represent this community and bring that to the nation because there's a lot of people out there that have no idea about African-American history.
Stephanie.
Yeah, I was going to say this gives us an opportunity for a couple of things. One, to lay the foundation of what had occurred before enslavement and to set up what the continent looked like before enslavement occurred, which gives a very different picture when you're looking at the slave capitals, when you look at the journey that African people had to take when they were being stolen and kidnapped. And so this is an opportunity to look at it because we look at enslavement, as it's always been said, as a disruption to African history. But this idea of it being a space and time, a moment, to be able to give us an opportunity to back it up and look at the continent look like before, understand what enslavement has occurred, the Ma'afa, as we call it, and then be able to see how it lays the foundation for everything that happens today, really, when we all think about it. And then the other thing, too, is also being able to look at the various forms of resistance that have occurred, because it's not just African people came to America, they were fiercely brought against their will, and they resisted every step and every moment of every day. So I think this gives us that opportunity to back it up, look at what Africa looked like, and then also bring in this notion of resistance.
Sure. So we're talking about a beginning in a way of 1619, the beginning. But if we put it in global context, we always have to remember that the history of black people does not start with slavery, right? You can talk about ancient African states, Egypt and Nubia, Ghana, Maya, and Songhai. And we also remember that the term slave comes from Slav, Eastern European people. And at 1619, there were more whites enslaved in the Mediterranean and North Africa and in Russia than there were African descendants in the Western Hemisphere. So we always keep that context of what we're talking about. And I also think about this idea of anniversary. Some people use anniversary. I like the term remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
I just celebrated a wedding anniversary. That was a very happy occasion. This is a more somber, more reflective, more sober reflection. And I think of remembrance as a time to respect, remember, reflect seriously, and honor our ancestors. So that's how I think about 1619.
Thank you. Now, this is a great start to this conversation. And now we're going to hear from some bright and curious 9 and 10-year-olds from a school in Hampton, Virginia. They have lots of questions about slavery and race relations.
If some of these statues were slave owners, it was such a horrible thing to have slavery. So my thing is, why? That's my question, why? That's my question, why? We have to know what our history was. Where is being taken from different places because they were that race? And I don't feel that any of that is right because we're all human beings. Now we're allowed to do stuff that we couldn't do before. We have to know this is why we're free and this is why we can do this.
I'm a few years ago in Charlottesville, Virginia, there was people in their cars who was running away by people. Me and my family took a trip, and while we were on our way, we were driving in Charlottesville, and we had to be very careful. I've seen on the news where a black man was trying to ask for directions, and he left on a white person's house. The husband came in and got a gun and chased the black man off, so I thought that meant he, well, is it because he was black, or do they think he was trying to, steal something? We thought it was really mean. Some people want to treat other people unfairly. Still, after all that happened,
people just don't get treated the way that they deserve. They just get treated very wrong.
Sometimes people think that it's still right to keep people separated. It's like it's happening again and people are starting looking it up again.
Black men, females, they're getting shot. People are losing their lives, and they haven't done anything. So I think we can improve that.
We live in the United States. United means that we're all in this together. But people aren't getting treated fairly because people are not doing the right thing. And we should only do the right thing.
Reparations. There's been a lot of talk about paying the descendants of enslaved Africans for more than 200 years of harsh labor. When we think about this idea of reparations, how did we have some, should descendants of slaves get reparations? We asked some people walking near the Washington Monument for their opinion.
The United States owes a great debt to the descendants of slaves.
It's hard to say that those people should get reparations when they weren't themselves a part of that.
This is going to be a big argument. Who deserves the money? Where is it coming from? our economy was built off of the labor of slaves, and everything we have now really is based on that.
I think it'd be good to look into. I think it's a good idea.
Try to fund it and try to find who is, who isn't, shouldn't get it, which is a hard thing to do.
I don't think that tracing back to slavery should be a requirement, because every African American faces racism and bias in this country.
Slavery was terrible, but that was a long time ago. So we got rid of slavery, and so that wasn't good enough. So then they got the vote, so that was good. And then that wasn't good enough. In Ireland, there's one tribe. In Sweden, there's another tribe. Here we have multiple tribes.
And considering that, we do really, really well.
Okay, we have 5 minutes, and that's a brief amount of time, to talk about reparations. And not just the cash check, but reparations that's connected to the young children we saw, about a healing of wounds. I'm going to start with Gloria Brown Marshall. Reparations. Well, briefly, why should we be having this national conversation about reparations?
First and foremost, we built this country on land stolen from the Native Americans, and now we have had this conversation about reparations that starts and stops since slavery ended, and there's always some politically expedient reason we shouldn't have the conversation. That bondage picture right there displays us as we were tied down, but does not talk about all we've contributed to this nation and had to go through 400 years of perseverance. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission is needed to first acknowledge the sins of the past and through them culture understand our past to get to the present situation, to better understand where we're going in the future of this country, or there could be continued racial conflict and we'll never heal.
Absolutely, we need to talk about reparations, and I'm so glad that we're having this conversation. When we look at the racial gap in terms of wealth, on average, the black family has 4% of the wealth of an average white family. When we look at health disparities, educational disparities that cross across racial lines, that is the result of intergenerational wealth gap and accumulation. And when we talk about slavery, we can't talk about it just as an evil. That's one thing. But we also have to talk about it as theft. The theft of people's labor. In the largest slave society in world history, 4 million people by 1860, the theft of that labor for 246 years for the benefit of others, even for those who did not directly own enslaved people, that's an accumulated debt that continued in the Jim Crow era, showed up in government housing policies, redlining, segregation, the whole nine yards. There's a material dispossession that we're still living with that has accumulated over generations, that's structural, that's systemic, and we need a solution that acknowledges and addresses those structural and systemic gaps. Dean?
America has what many legal scholars call a muscle memory. And because the foundation of our legal society rested in racial differences, there was a racialism that was put into law very, very early on, from the first moment that those Africans stepped ashore in the Virginia colony. And because of that, we have never excised that racialism from our law, from our society, from our culture, from our economic and social and cultural practices. So reparations doesn't just mean give somebody money. Reparations has to do with an overhaul to right a wrong. So we talk about equality, but we don't talk about equity. And equity is not, has not been addressed. And so reparations must start with equity first. And so when we talk about, well, we can't find the descendants, African Americans are the descendants, and there are some white people in this country who are also the descendants of enslaved people. And so the idea is, let us begin with equity, and let's right that particular wrong, and most importantly, let's begin to rewrite our narrative so that it is historically accurate, it is grounded in facts, And it is not about power, it's about truth.
Absolutely. I can tell you that Haitians are connected to this reparation and slavery debate as well. Dr.
Well, and it's not just the theft, it's also the continued theft of America, of black people, right? So it's a continual process, not just, they didn't just stop, right? It continues to go. But the idea of, I mean, getting to Omaha and thinking about how one spiritually heals and mentally heals from enslavement over generations, but also thinking about if it is going to be monetary in some capacity, then where does that money go to? And there's been a lot of suggestions about investing in black-owned businesses and black schools and, like, black neighborhoods, to try to really set things up in a more equitable type of idea. But for sure it has to come in a variety of different ways, but it's this continued fact that America keeps taking from black people over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And there's no debt. I mean, America can apologize all they want, but what's attached to it? There's nothing.
Superintendent. Well, the point I would make is that the American economy was produced by slave-grown crops, like cotton, sugar, tobacco. Those crops were sold to international markets to bring capital back to the colonies. The capital was used to build infrastructure that created a massive wealth for this country for three centuries. Now, let me give you some interesting information. In 1860, there were 4 million slaves in this country, and they were valued at $3 billion. That's 7 times more than the banks, all the railroads, 47 times more than the expenditures of the federal government. The first 8 or 9 presidents were slaveholders. Mm-hmm. Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, all the way to Tyler, Polk, and so forth. And all the chief justices were slave owners. Mm-hmm. John Marshall, Roger Taney. Mm-hmm. It breaks my heart. I'll just stop right there.
Briefly, with the time we have left, is to tell the audience and everybody who's watching this relationship between slavery and capital.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think sometimes we think, and contemporary, we saw in the video, there's some whites who say, look, my family didn't own any enslaved Africans, so what do I have to do with this? And the fact that slavery sets up this racial hierarchy and this racial caste system and white supremacy, white privilege, sometimes we can call white fragility, right? I want to talk about slavery and capitalism and what we could do right now. Sandy Darity and some other professors and scholars, and of course it's been in Cobra and Mary Frances Berry talked about Callie House and has the great book, My Face is Black, My Face is True. We've been talking about getting pensions and reparations, but what shape would it take? And there's new work looking at how black people's land has historically been stolen out from under them by the billions. I'll start with you, Warren. Very quickly, everybody tell me, what would your one silver bullet be, reparation?
In my book, Race, Law, and American Society, I look at property. Property and education, those two. Scholarships, free tuition to whatever colleges he wants to attend, as we had with the GI Bill after World War II, as well as getting our property back, but stopping the legal rape of black people through fines, through imprisonment, through the prison industrial complex.
That's it. I'm a historian, so I'm going to speak to history. I think we need to have a broad collective understanding of what actually happened in the past and how that past impacts on the present to create those racial disparities that we've talked about. That's the first step. Can we all have a broad collective understanding of what happened and where we are now? And then we can move forward thinking about how specifically to address those disparities in all the areas that we're speaking of, land, economics, housing, education, healthcare. Okay, thank you, Dr.
Overhaul of the white supremacist and racist structures that we have today because of inflation.
Well, I think we need financial literacy. We need to learn how to create legacies for our communities. In my lifetime, racism has never disappeared, so we need to work on building our communities and start financially. If you give me $10,000 today and you sit it in a bank for 40 years, I can create a legacy for my community. Thank you.
So I'm just going to say it in an example. Here we are at Norfolk State University. It's a historically black college and university, and shout out to Norfolk State.
Nova State began in 1935, and it continues today strong. But Nova State was underfunded, legally underfunded, or I should say non-legally, illegally underfunded for 75 years. And then the state settled that 75 years of underfunding with a tiny little bit of money. That is not equity. And yet we're supposed to compete with everyone else that did not experience that systemic inequality. And so that is what the faith is. That is where reparations needs to begin. It needs to begin with equalizing where we are and addressing the past wrong.
Thank you. In the U.S., some may describe the relationship between Africans and African Americans as a strong and historical one. What are the common bonds? What are the differences? We asked some Africans and African Americans living near the nation's capital for their thoughts.
I don't see any cultural differences because what I know is that all of what come from Africa, we want to follow the history.
They think that, you know, we don't take advantage of the things that we were afforded here, that we're not working hard enough.
Some of them see those that are coming from Africa like if they are inferior, inferior about them.
American-born African-Americans, we don't have a clue as to where we've come from. We don't have that benefit of having our culture, our food, and our customs and things, whereas the people who are coming directly from African countries do.
Those who are born here need to see those who are coming from Africa like their siblings.
And they need to learn the history of America. They need to learn, and it is not just black history. It is our history of America,
right? The women's march, the black power, everything has actually really helped us, and we've gained a lot from them.
We're going to be more synergy. We've got to find the common ground. Music may be the common ground. Football, I come together, games.
We all come together. We should all be one united family in the United States of America.
Okay, I want to open up this conversation to talk about not just the relationship between Africa and African Americans, but we are global people. Like I said, my people are from Haiti, the DR, other places. I want to talk about the relationship Africa, obviously, African Americans, but also that global diaspora. We have people from Brazil, the Americas, where my people are from, the Caribbean, which really had the most enslaved Africans. When we think about both the Americas and Latin America, South America, Brazil had the most. So what is that relationship now? Because I study the Black Power movement and anti-colonial movements, Pan-African movements. There was a point where that relationship was wonderful and it flourished. And I think about people like Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, Malcolm X going to Africa. I think about Sekou Touré, Azi Kiwe, all these different leaders, Kwame Nkrumah. And we've got Angolans and different African folks here. What has happened to that relationship? Why has it become much more complicated? And we can see some of those complications from what we just saw there. I'm going to start with you, Dean.
I think the reason it's more complicated is because after segregation in this country officially ended, and as we went through the 1970s and we started to see the removal of at least the visual signs of this inequality and separation, there was a sense among many African Americans that we had arrived. We didn't need to keep pushing black history. We didn't need to keep seeing ourselves as part of a diaspora, as part of a global community. And I think that there was a shift, and there were also political obstacles that were put in place for many people of African descent. We lost, in so many ways, these centers of protest. When apartheid finally fell in South Africa, because so many African Americans were behind the end of apartheid, it seems as if we felt like, okay, the world has now arrived. And a lot of the information coming out to talk about these inequalities, such as what is happening in the Dominican Republic with the people they call Haitians. They are Dominicans, but because of a color difference, they're seen as different people who should be ousted from that country. And so that information is not a part of our national thought because it's not in the national news. And so much of what used to be pushed through the black press is now diffused, and most people aren't even subscribers to the black press, so they don't know what's happening. So there needs to be a galvanizing effort to push that information out.
Okay, thank you.
I've traveled to Angola this past April. I've been to Ghana. I went to graduate school for a short time at University of Ibadan in Nigeria. I've been to other countries as well. And my major concern is the European, exchange scholar in England, learned the divide and conquer successfully and has been using it over many, many centuries. And that is what we're seeing here, to make the African more exotic. You know, someone who then they can say, we think you're the best in of the black people. We're going to focus on you and give you the scholarships and you the opportunities, because African Americans remind Americans, white Americans, of their history, and they remind white Americans of the original sin. And so if they can find a way to continue to marginalize the African American voice, the African American economy, and so that they can say it's not that we're anti-black, because we like those people from the Caribbean, we like those people from Africa. You African American, you have too much of an edge. You're too angry, and if you're coming into this country without having a sense of how this house was built, we built it. And so I think a lot of African Americans are looking at people from the Caribbean and from Africa and saying, do you not understand the price we paid for you to come into this country as you have and take advantage of what's here?
One thing that I'm going to go to Professor Jason. One thing I would add and contextualize those remarks is that we also have a rich and deep Pan-African understanding and history. When we think about Marcus Garvey and Amy Jack Garvey, and all these different people who've got Caribbean and African roots, and certainly Norfolk State University, Howard University, historically black colleges have been the root of anti-colonialism and the freedom that Nelson Mandela and other people had. Because we accepted Caribbean and African students at times, even when their own countries wouldn't accept them. So it's very important to remember that as well.
Absolutely. That's exactly where I was going, is that in 1903, W.B. Du Bois speaks of a global color line. And that dynamic of a global color line spoke to the fact of colonialism in Africa and other parts of the black world to legalize Jim Crow in this country. So that was a starting point to have a broadly shared sense of identity and a willingness for collective action. It began the conversation. Now those structures of legal colonialism and legal Jim Crow are not there, although we are still dealing with global white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little sometimes harder as the shape shifts to figure out exactly what it is and how it's hitting you at a certain point. But I think it's still there. And I think the way that we, as children of the diaspora and as Africans, we need to know more about each other and our specific histories. So for many Africans or Afro-Caribbeans coming to the United States, they may not be fully aware of this history of Jim Crow, et cetera, and how we have come to this point. Likewise, African Americans are not always very familiar with Africans. We don't know languages or customs.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we have a broadly shared sense of collective understanding and a history of collective mobilization, we still need to do the hard everyday work, person to person, of getting to know each other, our histories, our cultures that are specific, so that we see our humanity and respect each other's differences, even as we have these broadly shared similarities. That, I think, will take us forward.
People of European descent embrace white supremacy and know very well that if African people throughout the entire world unite together, that they will overthrow global white supremacy. So the idea is to dismantle that every step of every day. And how do you do that? The media is a huge piece of that. Right. Not only does it perpetuate in misinformation, as you're saying, with African people about African Americans and African people with African Americans, but then it plays on those misinterpretations and misorientation. So then there's so many misunderstandings that it's really hard to get people into the same room. Right. So the media is a key component of white supremacy, global white supremacy, to try to make sure that there is not that connection, because that connection is there and it can be there. You just have to get through the media in order to get there.
I don't think I have anything to say. That was well said.
I want to continue and expand, because I think one of the things when we think about the relationship between Africa, the Caribbean, and African Americans is the complexity that all people within that relationship find themselves, especially in the post-colonial, or we might say neo-colonial, landscape of Africa. But also, when we think about, I wouldn't call it a post-civil rights or post-black power, but certainly it's a white supremacist American historical context that we find ourselves in now. Rayford Logan called the late 19th century the nadir of black history. We could say there's a new nadir when we think about mass incarceration. If we move aside victories like President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and certain victories like that, the masses of African Americans are really suffering. So what do we say about the relationship where in the 60s and 70s we had this broad-based relationship where we talked about freedom and indigenous liberation, Pan-African, right? But then when we unpeel layers, we see that we face corruption at times in both Africa, but also in African American circles. Whether that's political corruption, whether it's people, we see what's going on with Colin Kaepernick and deals with the NFL and all these different things happening. What do we see about the complexity of that relationship? It's not as easy as up you mighty race, accomplish what you will in terms of Marcus Garvey. So what do we say about that, Professor Vincent and Professor Brown?
Right, it's harder. So really the anti-apartheid movement was a high point of recognizing what white supremacy looked like in the extreme. I know growing up in 1980s Los Angeles, I saw the similarities to a type of what I thought was a type of police occupation in South Central Los Angeles to what I was seeing in the townships of South Africa when I turned on the news. It's easier to make that connection. It's a bit harder to focus on, let's say, things that happened in Nigeria in the early 1990s and to figure out exactly what's going on here because all the actors are black. And it's harder to piece out. And so our Pan-Africanism now has to be still color conscious, but also look at these complexities of dynamics, right? That there are actors in the world that look like us that are not doing, right, for all of us. So we have to be a bit more nuanced and a bit more sophisticated as we look at the shape-shifting of white supremacy, some of the impact of it, but also the complicity of black people and some of these dynamics as well.
Absolutely.
And to piggyback on that, we are human beings, and not only are we always for 400 years and beyond trying to prove our humanity, we have the foibles of human beings. We have the same faults as a human being. And so we can least afford the selfishness, the classism. We can least afford some of these foibles, and we must understand when they gun down a black person in the street, shooting them in the back, they're not asking them whether or not they have a green card, a passport, or they're a citizen. They're dead on the street like Michael Brown and so many others we've seen. We need to understand that we are all under the gun and come together, not just based on oppression, because 1619 marks our history of commemoration, but there were Africans in the North American region prior to this time period. So we have been going through this struggle for not just 400 years, but probably more like 700. And we need to know by now there are certain things we need to trust one another. We need to trust that there are people who don't like us, and that's what we're going to have to just get over. And we need to understand this one last thing, and this one last thing is we need to think generationally, and as we come together as a people, whether or not we're from the African region, Caribbean, or the United States, other people are thinking generationally, and we need to think generationally. We need to think about what our great-great-grandchildren are going to be able to do, and if we come together like that as humans, we all love our mothers. We are all human beings. And if we think generationally, it doesn't matter what part of the world we come from, we can see with a true vision how we can be better in this world, the one we have right now.
Thank you. Now we are going to take questions from our audience.
Thank you for inviting me to speak today. I'm Calvin Pearson, founder of Project 1619. My question to you is that when this commemoration is over on Monday, where do we go from here? Because I'm seeing that there is a larger racial divide in our city and in our nation today than the same for the past 2 years. What did we leave behind, and where did we go from that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I'm just going to frame it by really amplifying one of the points that Professor Brown Marshall said about classism and these foibles or these complexities in our own community. That racial divide is connected to unequal power relations both within and across the racial line, so both between blacks and whites and Latinos, but also within those groups too. So how can we talk and discuss that? And even when we think about President Barack Obama and progressive politics, not all black people necessarily benefited from those either. We have black people generationally who are impoverished. What can we do post this conversation to try to transform that? Dean?
So here at Norfolk State University, one of the things that I'm hoping that we will continue to do is to educate future leaders, to get them out there with an understanding that we have, because we're grounded in all aspects of African peoples and the African diaspora, the history, the culture, the sociology, the health, all of that. And we're helping to train our students to understand that they have to step up and take leadership positions and not just look at a position as something that they're occupying, but rather they're like race men and race women of the latter part of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Their responsibility is to their broader community, that they must leave that door open and ensure that other people follow them who look like them, so that they're no longer at a boardroom and they're the only African-Americans in that room. They have to make sure that that room is not just one or two, but at least half, that they are representing many different voices in the community, not just theirs, not just the voice over here or the voice over there. That's one of the things. The other thing is education is critical. If you don't know what can happen, how you can make a change, then you can't make a change. And so there are grassroots groups made up of leaders who aren't out there trying to make money for themselves, but they're trying to change their communities and change the world. They're trying to make sure that agencies that have billion-dollar endowments, that they put that money into the communities and change those communities.
Thank you.
My name is Sherelle Lindsay. I am a freshman here in the Honors College of Norfolk State. And I have a question. Yeah, the question. So before I got here, I went to high school in Newport News, Virginia. And my teacher told me, you are very bright. Do not surround yourself around people who look like you. I took that very offensively, and I wanted to know this guy's opinion and if he had any advice for me.
So we're going to get as many questions as possible. We're going to just have one person do each one. Professor Brown Marshall.
Okay, as I said before, divide and conquer, it's been used many times. What we need to understand is by the year 2045, this country will be majority people of color. And what we see right now, the nationalism that was brought to the fore, is going to be more people trying to undermine the confidence of young folks, people trying to suppress the vote, the Supreme Court being packed with other people who are going to make our lives as miserable as possible. We are fighting in a ground war, an intellectual war, a social war, an economic war, and a political one. And I think we need to understand this young person is part of the collateral damage unless we get ourselves together and understand that we are in a situation in which people of African descent, no matter where you come from, are still being undermined as far as our progress goes. And we need to think about her and generations into the future. How do we see ourselves generationally, so that we don't have another incident like that, and a person with this much to go as far as her intellect is not going to be sent out in the world thinking there's something wrong with her because she's of African descent.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Young lady, you surround yourself. You surround yourself with people who affirm you and love you and care for you and see you for all the inner and outer beauty that you have. You surround yourself with those people. Those are the people you walk with in the world.
They will sustain you. You will help sustain them. That's what you do.
Absolutely. Thank you. Next question. Good morning. I was just taking in what the young lady before me said. I have 9 grandkids. And it's a beautiful thing as far as knowledge and guidance and stuff like that. And I was absorbing that for myself and my grandkids. And that was going to be my question. What's next for my grandkids? Let me start. My name is Al Murphy. I'm a 1985 graduate of Norfolk State University. Former television producer for Voice of America for 16 years. And for me, just growing up, I was the last one in our family to take cotton for money. I was raised about an hour away in North Carolina. And I've seen my, Ku Klux Klan being stopped by them. And, a lot of bad things, but there are also a lot of good people. Traveled to over 40 countries in sub-Saharan Africa in my career. And you get to find out people as far as what's in their heart were more alike than different. And that's what I've learned as far as over the 37 years as far as being a television producer in the U.S. diplomat. But my thing is that we need each other. And it gets started right now. That's my thing.
Do you have a question?
My question is, like I said in the beginning, I have 9 grandkids.
Yeah.
6 boys from 17 to 15, on down to 3 and 2. And when I'm driving in my car in the road, and I get pulled over by the police, and my grandsons or grandchildren are in the car with me, I have to tell them, you need to have your license right here next to you. Don't be fumbling around because you can get shot. Or something bad could happen to you. It's part of the mentality. So my question is, deals with generation.
Okay.
As far as educating one another. And my question deals with, what do we tell our grandkids people? What do I tell our youth as far as how does it start right now and working together? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'll call superintendent.
It's very, very sad. But I think, I work in a national park. I can judge America by who comes through the gate. And there are 419 units within our agency, and I've been to about 51 of them. There's Black Beat experiences and our resources in all those units. I think, there's a wide swath of people who believe that they are enlightened. They believe in racial equality. They create these policies that are really hard for us. And it circles back to what I said in the beginning, where we have to create legacies for our communities. See, I'm more interested in what freedom looks like. Like, if you pull me over erroneously, I have the means and resources to deal with that. I graduated from college with no debt because my parents put money in a FAF 29 plan. And with money left over to buy some assets. I'm very interested in what freedoms look like. So it's about self-improvement, community improvement. I'm going to be a negative person here, but I feel like we've been talking about education for a long time. And we keep having these circular conversations about improving the education system. There's a wide swath of people that have no clue about who we are. They don't know we're human.
Yeah.
Right? So we got to work on ourselves, and hopefully somewhere down the line that fixes some of these little issues that we run into all the time. Racism is always going to be around, but we have to fix our house.
Next question. I'm going to let you. I want to get as many.
Yes. My name is Reverend Justine Osborne, and I'm a South 71 graduate. Green and go. So my green. 2 years after I graduated, I decided to go into school of theology and another school in Richmond, where I live, Virginia Union. So I understand what you were talking about.
that the slavery comped was so very vivid. During that time, both schools, I ran into a lot of people that helped to shape my life in terms of their spiritual quality. They weren't Christians. Later, as I went into theology, I understood that the Christian route, many of them were forced to be Christian because they were bringing more money. I think about all the people that have made me rich.
I want to know.
Due to the way we were separated from our native African spiritual and cultural expression, making it evil to believe what we believe, practice what we practice, and making Christianity the right or the most righteous. What it has done to us both culturally and what it's done to
education.
Well, I think one of the powers of Black Studies, right, is that it's a space not only in the university but also in the community, because Black Studies is everywhere, right? We need to be more than just in the universities, but it is in K-12. I've tried in K-12 and other things in Philadelphia that are happening in the high schools. We just got an ethnic studies requirement that's being passed. The beautiful thing about ethnic studies and Black studies is it's not just education, but it's also movement and talking about actually taking action, right? So one of the places that you can really explore different African religions and spiritual systems is in Black studies, right? I've taught units in like sixth grade that dealt with Vodou, which dealt with Santeria, right? So this idea that Black studies is such an avenue for everyone to learn, Black students, Black people, but also non-Black individuals as well, to learn about these amazing religions that if you really look at Christianity today and different forms of religion and spiritual systems here in America today, Black people still practice this stuff. The baptism is just a water ritual, right, when you think about these things. So when you start to pull these connections and say, well, wait, that's really African, that's part of this, right, that's part of that, there's so much more commonality. It's like, that's your religion? Oh, that's what I do too, right? So I think one of the things is education can help to dispel some of these miscommunications and misunderstandings about different African religions. But it also is like that extra step. Like, go and learn something about it. Go to a Santeria ceremony. Go to a Vodun gathering, right, to learn more about it because it's so empowering.
Okay. We'll stop right there. Thank you. Next question.
My name is Violet. I'm from Zambia. I was really curious about what it looks like to make more diverse students. When I went to college in the Midwest, I think not only in my internship, I'm the only African in the room, but also the only female in the room. So I'm curious what the panel thinks about how to encourage more businesses, more churches, more organizations that serve people to encourage more diversity, not only ethnicity, but also background.
Yeah, I'm going to give that to Dr. Vincent, but as moderator and prerogative, I'm going to say one of the things that we don't do nationally anymore is talk about Black equality.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about diversity, we talk about multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
These are all myths. These are all fantasies. I live in Austin, Texas, where people say it's diverse, and there are no Black people there, but they'll say it's diverse because it's non-white people that they're accepting, whether they're from South Asia or China, anywhere but Southside Jamaican Queens, where I'm from, right? So part of it is talking about Black equality, again, in an anti-Black context where even Black people aren't bold enough and courageous enough to talk about Black equality. Black equality is the common denominator for social justice and citizenship for everybody. For everybody. We've opened it up for everybody, but we refuse to talk about it. And we talk about diversity and multiculturalism when we're not in the room. And they say, this is a great diverse picture. It's a diverse university. And I'm wondering, where are the Black people? There's a huge problem, Dr. Newman.
But what I would say, this idea of diversity, we do need to broaden out. And when we talk about
Pan-African movements, for instance, Black Power, Mark Scarvey, et cetera, one of the weaknesses of the movement has been the masculinist dynamic, not allowing women to come to the fore, at the center. One of the dynamics of Black Lives Matter, this movement now, is that it's led by Black women, queer Black women, right? And so there's a diversity in gender and sexual orientation. There's a broader space when we talk about diversity. I think our politics going forward, the question, where do we go from here, is a politics that is all-inclusive and that moves us all forward and that we look for spaces and create spaces that are diverse in every sense of the word, because that's what our nation is. And that's how we move forward, I think, going forward from here.
Yeah, we're gonna wrap that up right now. I think that's a great summation. I think this conversation is about citizenship, and Black people have been at the cutting edge historically of transforming and expanding American democracy, and giving Black people that due is very, very important. I think what Black Lives Matter has done, like Professor Vincent has said, is really place Black women and queer folks, LGBTQ, at the center of these conversations, and making a very similar parallel argument to what Black people did in the 19th and early 20th century, saying that if Black people got and achieved citizenship, it would reverberate to everyone. I'm talking about Native Americans, people who are physically and mentally challenged, people who are on the margins of society. But what we did is that we marginalized people within our own community, especially Black women. So what Black feminism teaches us, and we've got these great teachers like Sonia Sanchez, we've got Angela Davis, we've got all these brilliant Black women here. What it teaches us is how Black people's particular story can be universal. Sometimes people are saying, why are we always focused on Black stuff? Well, the reason we're so focused on Black stuff is because Black people are human beings in a society, America, that has historically tried to dehumanize us and demonize us, right? That's why we're so focused on the Black stuff. And so if you talk about Black citizenship, it means we're not excluding anybody. But when you don't talk specifically about Black citizenship, guess what? We will be excluded historically. So you have to talk about Black citizenship, always, anywhere.
Amen.
Okay, so this has been a great conversation. When we think about 1619 to 2019, the four centuries that we've been talking about is really what is at the core of American democracy. I want to thank all the panelists here who've contributed their knowledge and their passion. I want to thank the audience, and the audience can give themselves a round of applause here. I want to thank Brown Memorial Hall Theater at Norfolk State University for being a part of this, as well as Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, Governor Justin Fairfax, the Maine Ambassador, Barbara.
Actually, so that we don't have another incident like that.
Well, I'm going to stop right here. They're bringing that whole process to a conclusion. The conference that they had, that was back in August 23rd, 2019. And that was the Voice of America at Norfolk State University. It was hosted as an international town hall to discuss the 400th anniversary of the first Americans that landed in North America. I went back further with that particular presentation and researching to that, and listening to that whole hour-long segment. I wanted to have you listen to some of the kinds of things that were discussed a year ago, prior to this election, so that you can see of all the various things that are somewhat going in the wrong direction. There's nothing that's being stated about the pandemic, about the sickness that we have that's ravishing lives today, because it hadn't even started yet. So the focus at that particular time was on black people are being killed and by the police and different things like that. But, and if you heard, one of the people who actually discussed that, one of the people on the dais, briefly talked about that. You can see that they talk about it in a vacuum, away from all of the various other kinds of things that seem to be wrong in our society. They're all of like health issues that we have manifested during this particular thing. What Obama did in terms of the Obamacare made it possible for a lot of people to be able to survive right now, even though you have people who in politics that would like to take that away, leaving over 25 million people without any kind of coverage at all because they have preconditions. But in any event, it's a constant war of trying to hold abeyance of people who don't have respect or a willingness to want to be able to bring us all together as human beings, being able to function in our society as a whole. I actually started off the show talking about two presidents, how different they were. At one time, and by the way, I didn't say this, but at one time, John Adams owned slaves. When he became the vice president of the United States, he gave up his slave. He gave all of the slaves their freedom. And they lived, it wasn't a whole lot. He only had 12 slaves in Stato, and that was in Massachusetts. But he gave them their freedom, and that's remarkable when you consider the differences between him and the father, supposedly, of our country. Well, I wanted the show to go on for at least another half an hour. However, I just didn't have the time to research more information so it could tie into what you've been listening to. I would like to do something in talking about the third and the fourth and the fifth presidents of the United States. Here we are. The day is Friday, and the election is Tuesday. So that will give me an opportunity on Monday when our show will continue to talk about what these three or four presidents were able to accomplish in terms of alleviating slavery. And you will find a close similarity to what took place with the very first president of the United States. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and hopefully you'll listen and tune in this coming Monday, and while I will continue to discuss the differences of mankind and their treatment to others. My father used to say, when he was alive, he used to say, the mankind's indifferences are suspect to replenish different problems. Man's inhumanity to man. Those are his favorite words. So hopefully you'll listen at 5 o'clock from 5 to 6 on Monday, and we will continue this dialogue. Take care, people, and have a nice weekend.